Welcome to Let My People Think, the weekly program featuring speeches, lectures, and sermons by Christian apologist Ravi Zacharias. Our program format has been a bit different in recent weeks in order to accommodate a series of programs called the Top 5 Questions. As we continue this series, you will hear from not only Ravi Zacharias, but also from another Christian apologist, Dr. William Lane Craig. Ravi and Dr. Craig had the privilege of participating in a conference held on the campus of the University of Iowa, where they were asked to respond to the top five questions that university students ask about Christianity. When we left off last week, Ravi was answering the question, how can we know that Jesus' resurrection from the dead actually happened? Today, Ravi will finish up his response to that question before moving on to another tough question. With all of the world's religions, how can Christianity claim to be the only true way to God? Many people feel that it is wrong to say there's only one way to God. What about the millions of people in the world who are sincerely following other faiths? Hear what Ravi and Dr. Craig have to say about this.
There's a common sense question I had as a younger man studying this, and that was in the milieu in which they lived. Had the disciples really wanted to fabricate a claim and now had been beaten, having seen their Messiah crucified, why would they not have fabricated something that was unfalsifiable, i.e., he said he would spiritually rise again? How would the antagonists have proven them false? They would have said, well, he's lying here, the body's here. They say, but he spiritually rose again. What would you say to that kind of a doctrine? They went to the hard route and said he bodily rose again, so that all the skeptic would had to have done to have completely decimated their case, even years after it was first propagated, was to find the body. And once that body would have been found, the whole case for Christianity would have been collapsed, as the Apostle Paul himself said, if Christ be not raised from the dead, then our faith is in vain. They went the hard route. They did not go the easy way out because they were not trying to fabricate something. Which brings me to one personal application and one historical application. I was at a lunch with Dr. Billy Graham some years ago. There were just a handful of us in the room. And he was narrating some of his most dramatic moments as an evangelist who was in touch with world leaders. And I'll never forget the story he told us. I don't know if he's given it in this latest book of his, Just As I Am, because I've not read that yet. But I remember him saying this. He said, Konrad Adenauer, who became the chancellor in post-war Germany, called Billy Graham over to his room. And he said, Mr. Graham, I have a question for you. Do you really believe that Jesus rose again from the dead? Billy Graham said, as a younger evangelist, I was shocked. I was already nervous to be in the presence of a world statesman and then to have this question thrown at me. And Billy Graham said, I looked at him and said, sir, if I did not believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I would have no gospel left to preach. And he said, Konrad Adenauer paused, walked over to the end of the room, looked out of the window, and turned around and he said, Mr. Graham, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. An incredible statement from a world leader. Outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind. Put it in these terms. How would we view history if Christ was not who he claimed to be, and Christ did not rise from the dead? When you take the philosophies of history, it boils down very simply to this. The existentialist lives engaged for the moment. The traditionalist harks back to the past. If you know the words of the play, Fiddler on the Roof, what keeps us going? How do we manage to eke out a living? Tradition, tradition, tradition. The existentialist with a passion for the now. The traditionalist going back to the past, the utopianist kind of a pie in the sky by and by when I die, looking to the future. So the existentialist for the moment, the traditionalist for the past, the utopianist for the future. Jesus, when he broke bread after his resurrection with those two disciples on the Emmaus Road, who had few minutes earlier had the audacity to look at him, not knowing who he was, when he asked them, why are you so crestfallen? And they said to him, are you the only one in Israel who does not know what has happened? Ironically, he was the only one in Israel who did know what had happened. And there he sat. When he broke the bread, their eyes were opened. And the words would have to have come back to the mind. When he broke the bread, as often as you eat of this bread and drink of this cup, now. You proclaim the Lord's death in the past until He come in the future. He fused every moment of history with meaning, past, present, and future. So the resurrection is not only that which brings meaning personally, but that which gives meaning to history too. And that's why I think it's the peg on which the coat of Christendom ultimately hangs. Thank you.
And our final question of the top five, which will be handled first by Dr. Zacharias, is the question dealing with the exclusive nature of the claims made by Christianity and the gospel. The question is usually phrased in terms of, given that there are many people of other philosophies and religions and worldviews that are good people, and yet they have not placed their exclusive faith in Jesus Christ, how is that fair that those people are not saved?
I've always been fascinated by the fact that the Christian faith is the only one that has this question thrown into its face when the fact of the matter is, and listen to me very carefully, please, every major religion in the world has a point of exclusion. Hinduism, in its pantheistic worldview, with all of its accommodation and ideational comfort with various worldviews, when Shankara was going about lecturing and debating the doctrines that he believed, the monistic doctrine, he would do it on the basis of a debate, challenging any opposing view, with the assumption that if I defeat you in this debate and I defeat you in this argument, then my doctrine has triumphed over yours and you will have to submit to mine. People do not realize that Buddhism was born by rejecting two of Hinduism's cardinal doctrines. It rejected the authority of the Vedas and it rejected the caste system. Gautama Buddha did not accept the Vedic teaching as final, and he did not accept the caste system. In fact, one of India's early leaders took thousands of Hindus into Buddhism in a march because of the whole idea of the caste system that he too was against. So Buddhism also has its points of exclusion. Islam, as you know very clearly, is an exclusivistic claim to the way to God. So the moment somebody says to you, why is the Christian faith so exclusive? The fact is, all truth by definition will be exclusive. And all major religions of the world that I know, that I've studied, have points of exclusion. The only one that claims theoretically not to exclude any is Baha'ism. But Baha'ism does so while literally perverting all of the religions that I have given to you in their doctrines. Because certainly the law of non-contradiction is held by Islamic people, and they do not submit to the fact that it doesn't matter what you believe, that there's a common belief on the fundamental issues of God, man, creation, and all of that. There are fundamental points of difference. I make this comment. People often say religions are fundamentally the same and superficially different. May I reverse that for you and tell you that they are fundamentally different at best, and at times there may be some superficial similarity. There's a second point in that exclusivistic challenge. And it is somehow assumed that the Eastern systems, for example, are far more beneficent, and the Christian faith is the single one that sort of condemns and talks about a hell and an eternal lostness and so on. That also betrays a lack of understanding of most of those systems. The whole idea of a reincarnation is a system of paying back. The karmic law is a system of paying back a kind of a retributive aspect as you live the succeeding life in order to pay for the previous one. You might be fascinated to know this. I was interviewed on CNN, CNNI, after Mother Teresa's death, and several questions were asked of me. Very few people were aware of the fact that in the early days when Teresa went to Calcutta to work with the people on the streets of Calcutta, she had a big challenge on her hand. Several fundamental Hindu scholars wondered if she was interfering with the karma of the people on the street, whether they were not paying for their previous life and the wrongs in previous existences, so that the karmic law is operative even in that pantheistic worldview. So number one, all religions have their points of exclusion. Number two, even the idea of a judgment or some way in making a payment, as they would call it in those systems, for previous lives. But in the Christian faith, there is forgiveness. In one major religion that I shall leave unnamed, you never know if you're ever going to go to heaven. In most of the pantheistic systems, you pay. And when you come to Christ, you know that it has already been paid, for the cross gives you that forgiveness, not in any cheap way, but make sure that the graphic reality of sin and wrong is truly addressed on the cross. There's a very lovable little poem that I've often quoted in certain audiences. It was written by an elementary school teacher about a little child that had submitted an exam, and she wrote it this way. He came to my desk with a quivering lip. The lesson was done. Have you a new sheet for me, dear teacher? I've spoiled this one. I took his sheet all soiled and blotted, gave him a new one all unspotted, and into his tired heart I cried, do better now, my child. I went to the throne with a trembling heart. The day was done. Have you a new day for me, dear master? I've spoiled this one. He took my day all soiled and blotted, gave me a new one all unspotted, and into my tired heart he cried, do better now, my child. The glory of the Christian message is not one that scorches and condemns, but offers you forgiveness. And for years and years, as I have proclaimed the gospel, even in some very hostile settings in the land of my birth, when the concept of forgiveness is preached to them, that the cross is as real in its affirmation of what wrong was, but offers grace and offers forgiveness, it comes as a completely shocking idea to most people's sensitivities within those cultures, that there is a God who is pure, a God who is righteous, a God who is just, a God who claims an exclusive way, who still says to you, I'm willing to forgive you and receive you and offer you that eternal life. You see, our problem is really not that there is only one way to God. I am absolutely convinced if God had offered us 1,000 ways, we would have wanted 1,001. Because at the heart of our problem is not the limitation of ways, but at the limitation of our autonomy. And we want that freedom to either add or subtract to any other offering. So then we come to this final thought. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes unto the Father except through me. I find it most fascinating to who Jesus said these words. Do you know who he said it to? He said it to Thomas, the doubter. Thomas said to him, I don't know, we don't know where you're going, how can we follow you? Jesus said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes unto the Father except through me. And when he saw the resurrected Christ with the nail marks and he bent his knee and said, my Lord and my God, do you know where Thomas went to proclaim the exclusive claims of Christ? He went to the land of India, which talked about 330 million deities. And Thomas paid with his life. A memorial is 6 miles away from the very place of my birth in the city of Madras, India, where Thomas paid with his life to present the unique and the exclusive person of Christ. I lay on a hospital bed when I was a teenager. I was 17 years old, finding no meaning in life, not knowing which way to turn to the truth, and not knowing which way was right. And as I lay on that hospital bed, having attempted to take my own life, all my friends probably puzzled over this, and certainly my family puzzled over it, a Bible was brought to me. And it was in the reading of John chapter 14. Even at that, I could not hold the Bible, for my body was dehydrated. My mother, in her struggle with reading the King James English, nevertheless read the 14th chapter of John because somebody told her to read it to me. She was not able to process the thinking herself as she read it. And there I read the words of Christ, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes unto the Father except through me. And then Jesus going on to say, because I live, you shall live also. Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know him, I urge you not just to look at that exclusive claim, but to look at his birth, his life, his death and resurrection, and to see how he justified that claim and is able to transform your life. May I just make two applications out of that question and out of the truth that emerge. Jesus, for example, in his claims demonstrated at least two aspects. There are several I could bring to you. I've done a lot of writing on it. Let me just highlight two. The first thing that Jesus taught that corresponds to life as I've experienced it and as you experienced it, is that the human heart is desperately wicked, and he called it sin. The human heart is desperately wicked. I mentioned the Holocaust as I saw it a few years ago, and watching what Joseph Mengele and his cohorts had done in that room, and seeing the pictures of little castrated boys on the wall, and watching men and women leave there, particularly teenagers, literally sobbing as they walked out of the room. And I stood there alone, and a man standing next to me with his arms folded finally looked at me and said, "What kind of work do you do, sir?" I said, "Sir, I'm a Christian apologist. I travel from place to place defending the Christian faith. I'm also a minister of the gospel." He paused and he looked at me and he said, "You've got a lot to think about then, haven't you?" I said, "I most certainly have. I've never encountered anything like this." And then I said, "Sir, what kind of work do you do?" He said, "I'm a judge from the state of New York. I sit on the bench in the state of New York. I'm a judge from there." I looked at him and I said, "If you don't mind my saying so, sir, we both have a lot to think about." You see, those who engineered such horrors were the same ones who sat at night entertained by the music of Wagner. The human heart is desperately wicked. All the education in the world is not going to change your heart and mine. Jesus said that it was the heart that was wrong. Viktor Frankl, who was in concentration camps, wrote this: "If we present man with a concept of man which is not true, we will corrupt him. When we present him as an automation of reflexes, as a mind machine, as a bundle of instincts, as a pawn of drives and reactions, as a mere product of heredity and environment, we will then feed the nihilism to which modern man is in any case prone." Listen now, please. "I became acquainted with the last stage of corruption in my second concentration camp, Auschwitz. The gas chambers of Auschwitz were the ultimate consequence of the theory that man is nothing but the product of heredity and environment, or as the Nazis like to say, of blood and soil. I am absolutely convinced that the gas chambers of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and Majdanek were ultimately prepared not in some Ministry of Defense or other in Berlin, but rather at the desks and in lecture halls of nihilistic scientists and philosophers." Who we are is definitive of how we live. Christ's treatment of the human heart corroborates itself in our experience. But then he didn't leave us there. He talked about how he could change the heart of a human being, how he could bring that change within your heart and mine so that we don't only change what we do, but change what we want to do. Christ called that the new birth. C.S. Lewis, the author, traced his own conversion in these words. Remember, he was an atheist at one time, a pantheist struggling with that sort of worldview. And then he says this: "You must picture me alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which will accept a convert even on such terms. The prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who was brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance of escape? The words compelle intrare, compel them to come in, have been so abused by wicked men that we shudder at them. But properly understood, they plumb the depth of divine mercy. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men, and his compulsion is our liberation." Anytime you raise the question of exclusivity, look at the cross first, please, and see the invitation. Thank you.
I do want to say that it seems to me that this problem posed by religious pluralism, which is the burning issue of our day, is really just a subset of the problem of evil that Ravi talked about earlier. Namely, it's the claim that it's impossible for God to be all-powerful and all-good, and yet for some people to not receive Christ and to be lost forever, that somehow those are inconsistent, that if there is an all-powerful, all-loving God, then everyone should believe in Christ and be saved. Now, in order to show that those two statements are not inconsistent, All you have to do is show some possible way that God could be all-loving and omnipotent, and yet not everyone would hear the gospel and be saved. This doesn't even need to be a true alternative. It has to be merely possible. And I think that I can offer such a possibility that will show these to be consistent. And I don't know if this is the truth, but I think it's possible. And it would be the following: that God is in his omniscience, knew before he created the world exactly what every person would do in response to God's grace in any set of circumstances that God might place that person in. And he therefore knew who would freely receive Christ and the gospel if that person were to hear it. And therefore God has so providentially ordered the world in his sovereignty that all those who would respond freely to the gospel and be saved if they heard it are born at times and places in history where they do in fact hear it.
Well, at this point, Ravi and Dr. Craig responded to questions from the floor.
I do want to make two very brief observations. One is that I want to register a rather strong disagreement with Viktor Frankl's attribution of causation of the Holocaust to the philosophers. That strikes me as an interesting but rather extraordinary theory. It's surely far more the case that responsibility for the Holocaust rests with the ancient European Christian tradition of anti-Semitism. My second observation, with all due apologies to you, Professor Craig, is that I find the suggestion that those people that happen to be born in circumstances in which they don't have the opportunity to hear the gospel might be people who, were they to have heard it, would have rejected it. That is, for all of them to be of that sort, to be not only empirically implausible, but morally repugnant and morally dangerous. The question I want to ask has to do with the claim that both Ravi Zacharias and Professor Craig made, and so it's directed to both of them. Both of you made the claim that there would not be or could not be any objective moral law were it not the case that God existed. You made that claim. I didn't hear a defense of the claim, and I'm curious what that defense would be in the light of the fact that so far as the history of philosophical reflection on that issue goes, I think it's fair to say that the great majority of objectivist theories of morality do not invoke any deity whatsoever.
Let me say something first with respect to my suggested proposal that those who never hear about Christ have been so providentially ordered by God that they would be persons who would not have received Christ and responded to the gospel even if they had heard it. I don't think this is empirically implausible, because empirically that would be something that would be impossible to test, because it's a counterfactual claim. I mean, how would you disprove something like that? You would go to these people, share the gospel, they receive it, and you say, aha, see, they would have received it if they had heard it. Well, no, because now they have heard it. So what I'm talking about is persons who never receive the gospel, and I don't think that could be empirically falsified. But in any case, that, as you know, is irrelevant to dealing with the question of whether or not the logical compatibility of God's being omnipotent and all-loving and persons never hearing the gospel being saved is to be demonstrated. As long as this is even possible, it shows that those two statements are logically compatible, that there isn't any inconsistency, so that empirical plausibility doesn't even enter into it.
That was William Lane Craig with Ravi Zacharias on the campus of the University of Iowa, answering questions from the students and faculty there. The two apologists have finished answering the top five questions that the audience asked and are now answering other questions. We'll be finishing up this series next week. Let's review how Ravi handled the question on the exclusivity of Christianity. Ravi first pointed out that all major religions have points of exclusion, not just Christianity. Truth, by definition, must be exclusive. All the religions of the world cannot be right at the same time. Ravi also said that before someone condemns Christianity for being exclusive, they must recognize that Christianity is also an open invitation for all who want to come and accept God's forgiveness in Jesus Christ. Please join us again next week. Today's broadcast, The Top Five Questions, is available through Ravi Zacharias International Ministries as part of a two-tape album. The album features the complete responses of Dr. Zacharias and Dr. William Lane Craig to the top five questions asked by university students about Christianity. It also features an open session in which the speakers answer questions from the audience. When ordering, ask for tape number CA210, The Top Five Questions. That's CA210, The Top Five Questions. If you listen in the United States, place your credit card order by calling 1-800-448-6766. That's 1-800-448-6766. The order line is available 24 hours a day. When you place your order, ask for your free copy of Ravi's newsletter, Just Thinking. The newsletter contains articles by Ravi and members of his ministry team that can be a helpful tool for understanding the issues of our day. To order online, go to rzim.org. There you'll find information about Ravi's ministry, essays and articles, and archived files of the Let My People Think broadcasts. Once again, that's rzim.org. If you prefer to write, address your envelope to RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. That's RZIM, Post Office Box 921-939, Norcross, Georgia, 30010. In Canada, contact our office there at 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. That's RZIM, 2476 Argentia Road, Suite 203, Mississauga, Ontario, L5N6M1. We at Ravi Zacharias International Ministries are also excited to tell you about a line of apologetic resources that we have available. We have partnered with respected authors in various fields to develop a line of booklets called the Critical Questions Booklet Series. To learn more about the booklets, call us at 1-800-448-6766 or visit us on the web at rzim.org. Please be sure to give us the call letters of the station when you contact us. Knowing which station you're listening to can help us better evaluate the effectiveness of the broadcast. This weekly program, Let My People Think, is a listener-supported radio ministry and a production of Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, Atlanta, Georgia.